effective. The analgesics, including codeine, don't do very much. The tranquilizers don't help. The muscle relaxants don't help. And the patients are just generally miserable without knowing quite why. Because of the similarity of this kind of pain to that described in shingles by a lot of the shingles patients, and because we'd had very good success in relieving the discomfort of herpes zoster patients with a form of sublingual immunotherapy, about 4 years ago I thought, well, I would just try to see if we couldn't help these patients by using the same method but using polio vaccine in the treatment. And of course this was not a controlled study, and I made no effort to do any prior or post studies. For one reason, we have trouble following the patients who come to Warm Springs. They usually come for a few days and then they're gone. So in order to try to give some sort of credibility to this report, I did go back and pull charts on 80 patients that had been treated this way over the past 4 or 5 years. The patients ranged in age from 24 to 71. There were 33 males and 47 females. The residuals varied from almost complete recovery to profound disability. Symptoms had been present from 1 to 5 years, and many of the patients had gone through extensive studies with EMGs and CAT scans, even myelograms and muscle biopsies to try to determine what was causing their pain, and of course all the studies were negative. They had had a number of medications, as I mentioned before, and a fair percentage of them in desperation had been referred to the psychology department and had even been received psychiatric therapy. As far as the response, 47 of the 80 patients got what we considered good response. Their pain was very much relieved. There were 11 who did not respond, and 6 had a questionable response. There was no follow-up note in the charts on 16 of them. There were no side effects of any kind, except in 2 patients, both of whom incidentally did get good relief from their pain. One felt that the fasciculations he was having were somewhat worsened, and another developed fever blisters, which may or may not have been related to the treatment. The effect on strength, far as we know, there is no effect as far as we can determine. Some of the patients who have been on treatment for as much as 2 years do seem to have improved slightly in strength and function. But I don't know exactly how to interpret that. The method that I use is one that I use for treating allergies in general. It's based on the so-called antigen blocking dose. And I say to start with that it is not an accepted treatment by the allergists. All the literature references, while not saying that it is ineffective, say that the effectiveness remains to be proven. And I guess that's what we need to do. I've been using it for about 12 to 15 years with excellent results in a number of allergies. It's based on the concept of an antigen blocking dose. And that means that for each antigen that causes an allergic reaction, there is a specific dose that instead of causing the reaction will stop it. Doesn't make good sense just on the surface. But say you break out every time you eat strawberries, or you get hay fever every fall from ragweed pollen. There's a certain dilution of strawberry or ragweed that is individual for the patient that instead of causing the reaction will keep you from reacting. If you go ahead and eat, you can take your blocking dose, go ahead and eat your strawberries, or take your blocking dose of ragweed and go outside and not have any problems. To determine the dosage, we use changes in the pulse and temperature to serial dilutions of the antigen. and then the treatment is continued as needed by the patient by putting a drop under the tongue at whatever intervals he finds necessary to control his symptoms. We've never run into any side effects other than maybe some mild exacerbation of hay fever or whatever during the running of the to determine the dose. Now, I really don't know much else to say about this, except to me it puts an entirely different light on the way we're thinking about polio, and leads us into a number of other fields that may in the long run be related to what we're seeing with polio. The method of pain control by using a sublingual antigen dose, in other words, a diluted drop of salt vaccine specific for each patient, for that to control pain, it's pretty hard to even think of, and I realize I'm going to get out of my field when Dr. DeLancas and the other immunologists will step on me, I'm sure. It may have something to do with the newer theories of antibody bridging or antigen bridging of the lymphocytes to produce a reaction, or it may in some way stimulate the suppressor T cells to action. I have no real knowledge enough even to guess what that might be. Then there's the relationship of this to autoimmunity, which I feel very strongly is part of the whole picture. Whether the particular patients who develop these findings have a type of immune response to viral residue or some sort of viral template that is necessary to produce permanent immunity to a virus, I'm just speculating. And of course, as I said before, I really don't know what I'm talking about. But I think all of these things are of primary importance because they apply not only to what we are thinking of, but the other autoimmune diseases, including multiple sclerosis and rheumatoid arthritis or lupus and all of the other diseases that we understand so poorly at this time. I don't know anything else to say about it, Dr. Halston.
Would you raise your hand? Dr. Bailey, will you entertain questions and comments?
Yeah, I probably won't be able to answer them, but I'll be glad to.
There are a number of hands up. I think you've provoked a lot of interest and controversy.
We'll give DeLancas the first shot, simply so he can sit still for a few minutes then.
No, I don't really have any critical questions. First, I have a few questions, though. One is, how do you prepare the vaccine, the thing?
For the polio patients, you mean in general or for the polio patients?
For the polio patients.
For the polio patients, I take salt vaccine, and I dilute 1 to 10. I make serial 1 to 10 dilutions, and place a drop of a different dilution under the tongue at about 10-minute intervals, check the pulse and temperature after 5 minutes, and tell by the changes, go back a little bit. With each dilution, there usually is a change in the pulse and temperature, either going up or down from normal. As you approach the dose that is effective in blocking the reaction, the pulse and temperature revert back toward normal, maybe not too normal, but back toward normal. If you go past it, it usually resumes the trend away from normal. So your dose is, after doing the 1 to 10 dilutions and finding an area in which that starts, I go back and make smaller dilutions and kind of titrate to find a more definite dose for the patient.
So you skin tested the patients first?
I use no skin testing. I use all sublingual drops. I just put a drop under the tongue.
And did you use any placebo in...
I have not done any testing. Now, one of my patients, and this was my error, well, I'm kind of ashamed to tell it, but one of my patients got a kind of double-blind study. I inadvertently used the wrong dilution to make one set of her drops. She had been on them for a month or so. And when I gave her the new drops, she wrote me and she said, those new ones just don't work. Something is wrong. So she had a few of the others, and her husband, without her knowledge, varied which one of the drops he gave her. And she definitely had exacerbation of her pain and all with the wrong dose, with good control when she went back to the right dose.
Did any of the patients get worse?
No. No, it doesn't work.
Right. But theoretically it's possible, because some of these patients have not been immunized for polio, which is for three types of the polio virus.
It's possible, but I think I don't think they would have developed the allergic response to a strain that they had not already been exposed to.
And just the last question for my information. You said that you have been successful on the herpes zoster virus and the shingles on the pain. We have been having problems to control the pain after herpes, and I would like just to see
okay,
what...
Okay, I do the same thing. This is not my... I didn't originate this, and I'm embarrassed to say that I can't remember who did. Some work came out in about 75 or 76, and I know that it was a doctor over in Alabama, but I haven't been able to find the reference, and I don't remember his name.
What virus was that?
They used the flu virus. They used the flu vaccine that they were using for injecting for the flu epidemic, and he reported good results in controlling the pain of shingles doing that. So I used the flu vaccine, only I used it sublingually instead of by injection. And I have not yet had a patient with shingles who didn't respond with good relief of their pain.
Thank you.
I would like to ask a question. What we're treating here is this deep pain that is so very difficult to describe. And you relate it to the pain that some people get postherpetically. Do these people have this pain since the origin of their polio, or is this a later developed pain?
No, it has developed recently. The patients that I had had it from 1 to 5 years, but it was recent, just as these other developments are recent.
I would wonder from the rest of the people here, how many people are seeing this pain as a real problem? I'm going to give you a name, please.
Johnson, Columbus. We have just completed our fifth year on a chronic pain management program. I have seen 3 polio patients very similar to yours, but I would make the plea, like Dr. Halstead did, that we start defining our terms better. I think this is so very important, because what you describe up there on the kind of pain these people have, and in my experience, my 3 cases that are very severe, one of whom lives in Atlanta, and I'm sure you've seen her, is fibrositis. It's exactly myofascial pain. These are the problems that we see in the chronic pain service. So I just would make the point very strongly that it is not unique to polio. It is definitely not unique to polio.
I feel very much that too, as I was saying with the other things. But it's difficult to explain the response to this kind of therapy.
Miller, New York. There is a question. Are you using a single strain Salk vaccine or the multiple?
I'm using the multiple strain.
All right. Then Dr. DeLacus's point is particularly relevant, that a lot of people who have polio may not have been immunized, and giving them the multi-strain vaccine may be subjecting them to the small but very real risk that they will get polio, paralytic polio, with another strain.
This is the Salk vaccine. This is not the Sabin.
This is not the Sabin?
Salk.
Salk
vaccine. I have to get it out of Canada. It's the Salk vaccine, the dead virus. And most of the patients, surprisingly, have undergone treatment, even though they have had polio. Most of them have been immunized.
All right. There are further comments. The theoretical underpinning for the oral administration of a dead agent, such as polio, and creating an antibody response for modulating the antibody response virtually doesn't exist. And if this ever was a study of a process that could be readily submitted to a randomized, double-blind, crossover study, and this is it, and it seems entirely irresponsible to treat something as subjective as pain with an agent without doing such a crossover double-blind study.
I agree, and I hope that such a study can be undertaken.
Well, I would think
I won't be able to,
so
most likely.
Patients, that would be possible.
It's very difficult for us because our patients come and go, so it does need to be done.
Dr. Bailey, I'm Dr. Parsons from Denver, and I have a couple of questions for you about the way patients use the antigen that you give them. I take it that you make up a batch for them and they take it home.
They take it home.
How often do they give themselves a dose?
It varies very much with the patient. Some can take it two or three times a day and be comfortable. Others require, often I have some who take it even about every 2 hours.
Do you observe in these patients that they may start out taking it once or twice or three times a day and work their way up in terms of frequency of dose?
Usually the other way around.
They will start out with frequent doses and then
work down.
Need less as time goes
right.
by.
And that holds for other allergies.
Have you been able to withdraw any of these patients from the program once you get them on it?
I haven't attempted to. I'm sure that some of them are not on still because they haven't asked for any more refills. I don't know whether they, in the long run, were not helped. To be blunt, and I don't blame the local doctors, I probably would do the same thing. I know that some have been taken off by their doctors because they feared some adverse reaction. Most of the patients are not willing to. It's such a relief to them. The tight pain I'm talking about is so, I won't say severe, but it's a debilitating pain, and most of them are not willing to stop treatment.
Now, of the 80 patients that you cited for your follow-up study, did that include all of the patients that you made up substance for?
No, there have been some others. That was just 80 that I could pull in medical records quickly for this meeting.
Okay. At what point in time were you judging the results to be good?
Before they leave. If you're going to get a result, you get it immediately. And that holds for the allergies, too. If you have a runny nose from the ragweed and you get your dose, you go out of the office with your nose dried up. It's immediate.
Thank you.
Just one short question. When you arrive at the dose to be used sublingually, you say you monitor the pulse and the temperature.
Yes,
you wait
sir.
5 minutes and think, where do you take this temperature?
I do it under the arm because I'm using the mouth for the drops, so I do an axillary temperature. And it's the change that makes the difference rather than the actual...
Is it a mercury thermometer or is it a continuous printout?
No, it's a mercury thermometer. I use the same thermometer, though, throughout for each patient and try to use the same length of time for it.
That was Stoloff, Washington.
I'm Richard Owen from Minneapolis. Have any of your patients with these pain syndromes been on an heavy exercise program or conditioning exercise
program? Some had been. Most of them have stopped by the time we see them, but some had been.
Have any of them done formal cardiopulmonary conditioning programs that you know of?
Not that I know of, but it's possible.
Let me inject a question. Is it your feeling that this pain is related to polio or that it's totally unrelated to polio and just an incidental finding in these people?
I think it's a big part of the whatever's happening to these patients.
Bodie in Baltimore. Have you tried anything else besides the, quote, specific polio antigen?
Not for these patients, no, sir, I haven't. I've just done just the polio for them, mainly because...
You've never tried anything else?
That's all.
Sublingually?
That's all for them. I have used only the polio vaccine for them, primarily because in treating other allergies, the antigen is so very specific for whatever you're treating for. for instance, as I said before, the strawberries. You have to use strawberry if that's what's causing the trouble, and it will clear up the strawberry reaction, but it won't affect any other allergy that the patient may have. It's very specific.
But in order to find out it's specific, you must have tried other things.
I have most of my patients, we could go a long way. There are some patients that come to you with a rash that you don't know what's causing, and you try a number of things before you maybe find the right thing, particularly foods that are so notoriously unreliable as far as skin tests are concerned.
But you haven't done so. You haven't tried other things.
Haven't tried. Not in the polio. I have with rashes and things that I didn't, when I did not know what the particular antigen was. And I stress again that I have not attempted any kind of study. I've just been doing this only to try to help my patients.
McKinstry, Warm Springs. I've been doing the follow-up of the patient since Ann left, and I've been seeing approximately 2 to 4 patients a week with polio. And these patients swear by this treatment. And I don't know the basis of it, but I am convinced that there's something, whether it's psychological or what it is, that's benefiting these patients, because it's almost miraculously when they come and tell me about it. The other thing, Ann, that you didn't talk about the survey, we have a large number of polio patients on a registry here at Warm Springs, and we've done a survey, which everybody else has talked about. You might want to mention your survey.
Well, I think it's so old and out of date, and I don't think adds anything to the surveys that have been reported. I think we first tried a little one, but our response was about the same as everybody else.
Herbison, Philadelphia. Have you tried anything like Indocin or?
The patients have all had Neverson. Those things, right. They have had Indocin and all the non-steroid anti-inflammatories. Some of them have even been on Tylenol, and as I say, codeine, or even other things. They've been on the Elevil and the Valium and all of those things with very poor results.
One of the other things that has always impressed me when I've taken a look at any kind of diseased muscle is that, in a sense, it's an end-stage process. For instance, we've talked in the past about a neuropathic muscle that eventually looks like a myopathic muscle. One of the reasons why I brought out earlier on that a muscle can become diseased if it is markedly overworked by elimination of synergists, if it's markedly overworked because it's severely denervated, if it's markedly overworked because of the fact that it is multiply exercised through weightlifting types of contractions, or it's exercised as a result of lengthening contractions, the end result in the muscle is almost identical. And it seems to me that it would be imperative to do exactly what Dr. Bodian mentioned, and that is to do a double-blind study. I think that when you have a common denominator type of response in a muscle, that it's absolutely essential to determine whether or not these different processes will respond to similar types of therapeutic intervention. And then, of course, do the crossover study and see exactly what happens.
I agree wholeheartedly that a double-blind, thought-out double-blind study with some objective findings as well, with EMG studies and other things, because one of the primary things that the patients report to me and some of the physicians have reported as well is that there is no question that the fasciculation is reduced by using this treatment. Now, what that means, I don't know. But they all feel that the fasciculations are less.
Just one quick comment on you skipped over your survey, but I think you were too modest, because it came out at a very critical time, along with the one that the Survivor Association at Goldwater did. And I think it very much established the basis of beginning to do work in that area, and I don't think you should be that modest about it. I think it was a critical beginning in that kind of thing, and the fact that it came out of here was very significant.
Thank you.
Johnson, Columbus. Dr. Bailey, did you find most of the discomfort in the more severely disabled or weak muscles, or did it make any difference?
Didn't make any difference, and I can't say that it was in a muscle, because like I say, the patients say they felt like they do when they have the flu, and you know, that's, you feel sick. It's not that this muscle hurts or that muscle hurts. They feel sick. And but it didn't matter. It didn't seem to have any correlation.
Dr. Bailey, a correlate to that, was there any distinction in terms of the type of polio they had or the type of involvement?
We didn't have that information on most of the patients, and most of them did not know. See, they were not patients that, well, a I few, of course, were, but they were not patients that had been followed at Warm Springs.
So you don't know if they were bulbar, if there was respiratory involvement at first?
We have that information. I guess some were severely involved and some were minimally involved. Didn't seem to make any difference.
How about fever at the time of having pain?
I can't answer that, because this was just a history as given by the patients.
I mean fever presently.
Oh, presently, no. No, no, okay. They don't have fever now.
Well, I think there's going to be a run on Salk vaccine while everybody tries this technique.
It's not easy to get it.
Did you happen to do sedimentation rates and eosinophil counts on
I did not.
These patients?
I have not done any of the things that we should do. We had, Dr. McKinstry will tell you that we had kind of worked out a planned program for doing a double blind, but we haven't started it, haven't done any of that yet.
Parsons again. Something you just said flipped a switch for me. The first two presentations that we had, we heard about a symptom called fatigue. Now, since the same word may mean different things to different people, I've had some difficulty finding out exactly what fatigue means to a polio person, whether that means lack of endurance, or whether it means feeling depressed because they're getting more disabled, or whether it means the aches and pains that go along with having an acute case of the flu. Are you talking about a phenomenon that patients in this area describe to you in their colloquial language as pain that someone else might call fatigue?
Very possibly. In fact, some of the patients do call it fatigue rather than pain, and then if you press them, they will give these other descriptions. Yeah.
I'm going to need some therapy in a minute myself.
Dr. Catherine Hoffman, Atlanta and Warm Springs. And what are your criteria for giving them the polio? How do you decide which of the patients who complain of fatigue or discomfort get the vaccine and which ones aren't eligible for that?
Any of the patients that I have had who complained, who had this type of complaint, I have given it to. I don't withhold it from anybody that I think will help. In fact, I have given it to a few who knew about it that I knew beforehand did not have this typical pain, and that's a good many of the ones that got no response. But I have not withheld it from anyone that I thought it would help.
Dr. Bailey, you indicated that some of the patients had also headaches and insomnia that accompanied the pain. Do you suspect that this was a more generalized problem of anxiety and depression that these patients had?
I don't think so at all. I don't think it has anything to do with emotion.
You think the insomnia and the headache was sort of...
I think it's part of whatever this fatigue pain syndrome is. Maybe I shouldn't use that word, syndrome.
Where can we get the Salk vaccine? I guess that's the next question.
Well, there is a company, Cono, I think that's the way you pronounce it, C-O-N-N-A-U-G-H-T or something of the sort, Cono, that distributes it for a company in Canada. They distribute it out of New Jersey. I know that's the way I get mine.
I know Dr. Bailey has mentioned before the talk today that she would be willing to teach anybody here who would be interested in learning her technique. Is that true?
True.
And so those of you who are stimulated to perhaps initiate a double-blind crossover study, if that's what's indicated, this is the time to take her up on that, because I think as with all new modalities in any area of science, there's always going to be some that are going to leave us scratching our heads and smiling. We've got but I think it would be good to find out once and for all whether in fact this can be effective. Dr. Miller.
Want to take a couple more questions?
Name. Miller in New York. I really want to make a comment about the moderator's last point. It's something different when there's a new treatment that has some type of theoretical substrate to its use, and then whether it works or not becomes a difficult question to resolve, even in the most diligent of hands sometimes. But when you take treatments like carbiazin and treatments like this, which have no theoretical substrate whatsoever, to then suggest that we better try it out because it's now here. This replicates the story of the snake venom, that when it didn't work in ALS, well, it was there, so we were going to try it in MS, and on into the night with things that just don't work, diffusing a great deal of time, money, and effort from efforts where good results could be obtained. And you have to remember that at the time, there were many prominent physicians in the United States who put leeches on their patients because they thought it worked.
I have to agree with Dr. Miller. I would like to...
And the idea of people, you know, starting to learn this technique and starting to try it out in small groups on their patients.
If that's not done, we'll be sitting here...
No, what has to be done is for the people who are doing it now to perform a double-blind control study and show their results really have some type of scientific validity. Not everybody else in the United States getting in on the act.
It does take some practice in interpreting the results, and I agree with that. On the other hand, I'd like to, and I know that some people say they don't bother to read that, but there was an article in a recent JMA journal about the tomato effect, and I think we may have something of that here about the, if those of you who've read it.
I tend to agree with what Dr. Miller said. I think that it is extremely questionable whether or not a treatment that has at best dubious value to be subjected to patients indiscriminately when there's an opportunity here with Dr. McKinstry to... Pardon me? Well... then perhaps it should not be done at all. But I think that for people to go off and begin using a drug that has absolutely no indication in terms of its value, your results indicated a 50% improvement, which is no more than a placebo improvement. And this is the sort of stuff that hits the newspapers, while those individuals that are performing long, drawn-out, methodical studies are plugging along and not finding immediate results are totally ignored, I think is really has very, very questionable value. And I would also disagree with the chairman, if I might, that we may well be sitting here a year from now, but I'd rather be sitting here a year from now with a decent research study demonstrating either the value of this technique or the opposite. I think that these are the kinds of studies, this is the kind of approach that should be taken in a very well thought out, very controlled method where there's enough patients that it can be done in a double-blind manner. I think that it's just extremely reprehensible to subject a group of individuals to a form of therapy which hits the newspaper and makes it appear as though we have an answer to a problem, the nature of which we're not even too sure what the definition of the problem is.
We have tried very hard to prevent that. I hope it won't get into the newspaper.
Unfortunately, this is the kind of stuff that does get in the newspaper.
Dr. Catherine Hoffman again. And the patients I've seen since I've been back here, I've been impressed with the fact that there may be some hysteria involved in their having heard about the effects of the dramatic effects of the vaccine. And it really seems like it would be important to get MMPIs on the people.
I agree.
To have some objective testing.
We really need a well-worked
up program. And to do a double-blind study. And to get some good information.
I agree.
The other thing, one reason the double-blind study was never done in Ann's defense, she feels very strongly that this is part of her treatment program, and this is encouraged. And let me change the subject from polio. When I came here as medical director 3 years ago and Ann was doing this type of treatment, she also has the same type of situation using something else for arthritis. Well, the Arthritis Foundation came down as well as the National Institute of Health, and they did nothing but encourage us for her to continue doing what she was doing.
Well, it seems like Larry is going to end up doing the double-blind study down here.
Okay, thanks very much, Dr. Bailey. We're going to take a break for coffee. Once again, Dr. Fisher has a film on patterns of polio breathing, which will be shown during the coffee break. Otherwise, we'll reconvene here at 4 o'clock.
That concludes tape number 8.